KUOW podcasts are made possible by listener support. Become a new or renewing member today at KUOW.org.
94.9 Seattle.
Every concern was addressed along the way, and I think the next natural step for all of us is going to be a lot of hard work, but I'm extremely confident that we have the team and the people in place to make this a reality.
A lot of times what happens in outbreaks is that the consumer is the canary in the coal mine.
And if the banks collapse, the whole Cyprus, everything collapses. That's what we're afraid of.
Today on Weekday, we're going to talk about Cyprus and the fears of bank failure. We also heard a lawyer who has fought to see the food safety system extended. We're going to talk about that extension that's being proposed by the FDA. And you heard Mayor Kevin Johnson of Sacramento talking about their effort to keep their basketball team in their town. That's all coming up today on Weekday. I'm Steve Scherer. Thank you for joining us. Appreciate you being here. We start inside the city of Seattle. Seattle is nearing the end of a years-long process to rezone its South Lake Union neighborhood into a denser and taller neighborhood. One of the final points of discussion is whether to increase a fee paid by developers who want to build taller than the city's height limits. The money is supposed to pay for affordable housing in the neighborhood that is allowing the denser, taller buildings. Many on the Seattle City Council argue that the fee is too low. Two recent consultant reports show that developers find it more cost-effective to simply write a check to the city to cover the fee rather than build the workforce housing themselves, though encouraging developers to build that housing was one of the goals of the city's policies. The council is having a hard time using that fee in lieu of, that's what it's called, using that fee in lieu of money to meet its goal of providing citizens with affordable housing based on the city's numbers. That's housing for a family of four earning between $52,000 and $64,000 per year, or housing a single person might be able to afford earning between $36,000 and $45,000 a year. The fee isn't generating enough money to build all the necessary affordable units in these upzone neighborhoods or throughout the city. Also, often the money ends up paying for very low-income housing instead. Now, in these last-minute discussions, opponents say it's too late in the game to make changes to the city's standing policy, and they risk cooling off growth in one of the city's fastest-growing neighborhoods. It's an issue that we have dealt with time and again, and we will continue to deal with. How do you keep the city affordable for the people who are working in the city when the economic drive is bringing lots of wealthy people into the city who want wealthy housing? So various proposals are being discussed in council this week before a possible vote next week. Seattle City Council member Nick Licata is proposing raising the in lieu of fee higher than most of his other colleagues. He joins us on the phone. Nick Licata is a longtime Seattle City Council member. Nick, it's good to talk to you again.
Thank you, Steve, for having me on your show this morning.
Also with us is A.P. Hurd, vice president at Touchstone Corporation, the author of Carbon Efficient City. She teaches sustainable development and regional economics at the University of Washington. AP, thanks for talking to us.
Thanks to be on the show, Steve.
A very interesting resume you have to be talking about development. But that, in part, makes sense because your ideas are that a taller city and a denser city makes for a more environmentally friendly city, correct?
Yeah, that's true. I mean, if we have a city that is more compact, it can be better served by transit in a cost-effective way. And we know that in our region, where a lot of our electrical energy comes from hydro, reducing our car trips between buildings is the number one thing that we can do to reduce our carbon emissions. That being said, I think that, you know, making sure that we also build lots of supply of housing in the city, particularly given how many people are moving here, is really important to keeping the city affordable over the long term.
And Nick Licata, I don't think there was anything that AP said that you would disagree with, is there?
In fact, I agree that we definitely want to have more people live in the city. It will cut down our carbon emissions. And I think the discussion really is about South Lake Union being, in some ways, a touchstone for the future of Seattle. Do we want to create a high-density enclave in Seattle that's primarily white bread, or do we want to have more texture to it and the whole wheat, where we have a diversity of people living in South Lake Union, and we meet the immense gap that there is right now in providing affordable housing. Without affordable housing, people travel from outside the city into the city, and you need them to live in the city, as AP Heard just mentioned, so they cut down the carbon emissions. Right now, 37% of the people living in Seattle, 37% of the people working in Seattle live in Seattle. The rest commute from outside.
What is the possibility, though, that government can encourage the construction of lower-cost housing?
Absolutely, it can encourage. In fact, it's interesting to note that the five cities that have robust either incentive zoning or inclusionary zoning, basically that government plays a role in saying, developers, you have to provide housing, affordable housing. Those four cities, let's say New York, Chicago, Philadelphia, and San Diego, all have between 50 and 72% of the people who are working in the city, living in the city. We only have 37%. And if you look at, for instance, San Francisco, which also falls into that category of having more people live in the city, I mean, work in the city, live in the city, and have a strong affordability program. San Francisco, which I've modeled my program after, was named recently as the top real estate market in the country for being the most vibrant.
Well, AP Heard, AP, go ahead and respond, and then I'll also ask you a question, but we didn't hear the beginning of what you said.
Oh, so I think, you know, the question of how many people live in, what percentage of the people who work in the city also live in the city is very dependent on the size of the city and how big the cities are in a metro area. So it's very difficult to make comparisons across metro areas. I guess, you know, from my perspective, it's important that when we look at other cities like San Francisco, that we really evaluate the effectiveness of their policies, because there's absolutely a role for government to play in providing affordable housing. But we have to recognize that the bulk of the housing in our city that is affordable today has been built by the private sector. So we need to be very careful when we're putting in place policies to provide affordable housing that we don't inadvertently have the unintended consequence of crimping the supply that needs to be brought onto the market by the private sector.
All right,
I think that's one of the things that's happened in San Francisco. And if you look at, you know, San Francisco has kind of probably what Nick has described as sort of a model government affordable housing policy. And in that sense, it is very aggressive. But in the period of 2000 till 2010, San Francisco has had 108% rent growth compared to Seattle's more modest 45% rent growth. And so we need to be really aware of, like, how well are those policies performing at an aggregate level across the city.
All right. Well, why, AP Heard, aren't developers putting affordable housing units into the buildings they're proposing to build in South Lake Union to the level that would meet the city's own goals for that neighborhood?
That's a good question. So maybe it's helpful to look at housing as sort of how it happens over time. Typically, the newest developed projects are the more expensive ones because they have to charge a rent that covers the cost of new development. As the housing stock ages, it becomes more affordable. And so we need, that's kind of one factor that's really important to keep in mind, is the housing stock we build today isn't affordable the moment it's built, or some of it is less affordable, but as it ages, it becomes more affordable. At the same time, when new housing stock comes on the market, it takes some of the price pressure off the market as a whole and allows the overall average price of housing to come down. One other factor that's particularly important to consider in South Lake Union is that we're talking about a specific construction type of high-rise housing that is more expensive to build because of fire codes and other particular rules. And so we're talking about a housing type that is really the most expensive construction type, and therefore it is kind of more difficult to make it particularly affordable at the beginning of its lifespan, even though it will become affordable over its useful life. There are other areas of the city that are zoned a little bit less high where there's a type of construction that's called stick frame or 5/2, and that produces many units that are affordable even as it comes on the market.
Well, Nick Licata, given that explanation, what should the city do in South Lake Union with the existing housing stock, the existing buildings, as this rezone proceeds?
Well, there's a plan for doing 33 new towers in South Lake Union, so that is where our opportunity is. We're going to be upzoning South Lake Union, which means basically transferring millions of dollars of value to private investors or private landowners. If we do not attach a public value to that, that the public will gain, we will be losing a tremendous opportunity to create thousands of units. My proposal is that we set aside 10% of the units that are built on site as affordable, and if they go off site, which is called in lieu, do 15%. Right now, according to our own Office of Housing, we have a huge gap. Right now, it's basically 1,700, and that will grow to 4,200 by 2031 that we're planning for. So in the year 2031, under the mayor's plan, we'd be providing an additional 450 units. Under the best scenario for the other council plans is 700 units, and I'm proposing 2,800 units. And I get there by modeling it at a more modest level than what San Francisco has. They go up to 20% of their units should be of actually 55% of average medium income. So my plan has been referred to as the Lakota Leap in sort of a gentle way, and I think it is. I think it's a bold move. I encourage the city to do it. I encourage citizens to basically pitch in and let us, the council, know whether you want more affordable city, more affordable housing in the city, because if we don't, more people are going to be working in the city and traveling outside. For instance, there's a new hotel, probably the largest in Seattle, that will be built where the current Greyhound station is, and there will be 400 people working there with the average salary under $30,000 who could all use affordable housing. So if people support the Lakota Leap, I encourage them to take their cell phone and send an email to sally.clark@seattle.gov. She's our president, a great president. She'll make sure we get all the message. And the subject line, just put down, take the Seattle Leap, and they'll know that we, the citizens, want more affordable housing in South Lake Union.
Nick, you're using marketing. Look at Nick, you are essentially saying, developers, we want to take some of your profit, and we want you to pay for affordable housing.
Absolutely.
Well, AP Heard, that's what he's saying. Do you think that's a good idea? I know you don't. Why isn't that a good idea? AP, are you still there? There you go. We didn't hear you. Go ahead, AP.
I think we need to have a strategy that balances out the cost of providing government-provided affordable housing across the city in a more balanced way. We also need to take the time to do it right. I think one of the biggest concerns of the development community is that these numbers have been sort of sprung on us at the very last minute in a rezone that has been really 8 years in the making. And one of the things that, you know, I think Councilmember Licata misstates a little bit, is that the government policies are what's going to provide all the affordable housing. And in reality, again, it's the private sector that provides most of the affordable housing in the region, and has historically. And so I'm not saying that we shouldn't have policies where government subsidizes some of the housing. We absolutely should. It's a key component to protecting some of the most vulnerable people in our city. We have to figure out how to do that. But we have to do it in a way that's a little bit more balanced, where we have a little bit more input from the market, and also make sure that we don't inadvertently crimp the supply of housing and wind up in a situation like San Francisco's. You know, I think taking leaps is really lovely if you know where you're going to land. You know, Indiana Jones sometimes does a great job of leaping without knowing where he's going to land. But I don't really favor an Indiana Jones approach to policymaking when we could have some serious negative unintended consequences. And just to put it in context, the mayor has actually appointed a committee that has about 15 people on it that is already meeting to study what policies we can put in place at a citywide level, because this is really a citywide issue. It's not just a South Lake Union issue, to figure out what is the right combination of private sector investment and public sector investment that can help us meet these targets over the long term. I'm really passionate about getting this right because, you know, I'm in my 30s. I plan to have a long career in Seattle, and cities that don't welcome in new people of all income levels are not cities that thrive over the long term. So I'm very, very motivated that we get this right, but we need to understand that there's multiple sources of how this housing comes to the market, and we need to not have so much of one source and kill all the other sources. That's what I feel is very important.
But he's not talking about protecting the most vulnerable. This proposal is about developers building housing in that neighborhood for people who are making money, but just not enough to be able to afford to live in that neighborhood.
That's actually where the proposal was at the beginning, Steve, which was to do in-kind, but that's actually been found currently to not be allowable under Washington state law. So what Nick's really proposing is to raise the fee in lieu, and actually all the fee in lieu that has been paid for the last several years that this program has been in existence has gone to the city's Office of Housing, and the Office of Housing has requirements to disburse that back out to people who make below 60% of area median income. So until we sort of correct that mechanism for where the fees go, it's going to be very difficult to get the kind of workforce housing that we're talking about.
All right, Nick, I'll let you respond in just a minute, but one clarification. How do you think that raising this fee in lieu of, which I understand is a raise of the fee, but it's also supposed to encourage developers to build this affordable housing on site or in the neighborhood. How do you think either Nick Licata's proposal or the other proposals that are slightly less as they step down towards what's in place now, how would it crimp development?
Well, let me give you an example. Nick Licata's proposal is to raise the fee to $120 per FAR. FAR is a measure of square footage area in a building. And when we look at that fee, you know, we can buy land that has FAR buildable rights associated with it, you know, depending on the neighborhood, somewhere between, you know, $40 and $65. So if you have a choice to just buy land that has FAR that you can build associated with it at those much lower price points, you would be better to buy two parcels and build to the lower price point than to buy one parcel and then spend more than you would otherwise spend in the market to build up to the extra height. These fees are part of what's called incentive zoning, which is building above what an area was formerly zoned. And so if you have a fee to go higher than what was zoned before, that is more than the underlying land price, then people are just going to build to the base zoning, which is the old zoning, and you're not effectively going to get more development in that neighborhood than you would have otherwise. And so then it kind of comes back to being a failure from both a carbon emissions and a supply point of view.
All right, Nick, you were going to respond, but pick up with that one notion there. Nick, you'll have a smaller, less dense neighborhood. Some people might like that, but I don't believe that's your goal.
Well, first of all, the numbers I'm talking about are not all in lieu. Because we are granting a upgrade in zoning, you can require what they call performance or on-site development in exchange for getting the upzone. So it's not all in lieu. In fact, in San Francisco, 80% of the housing that they've provided through their program turns out to be on-site or performance. So that's not true about just doing it off-site. It'll be a combination, certainly. A couple other quick comments. It's not just a question of supply. That goes back to Reagan economics and supply. Supply is going to be the solution. Seattle's expanding. As you build new housing, what often happens, we have new immigration coming in. And many of these people coming in are displacing people who already live here, who already live and work here, and they're being pushed out of the city. So we need a policy to keep Seattle's residents in the housing market. That's what's critical. I would say that if you look at the risk factor, right now, out of the 10 most active municipalities for apartment construction, Seattle ranks the second lowest in risk. All the others are considered higher risk, but if you look at cap measurements. So there is a tremendous demand in Seattle to build. We should go citywide, but we're talking about South Lake Union now. And let me just add that the idea of having a task force is a great idea. It's good to have developers, both for-profit and non-profit, sit down and talk. It should have been done a year ago. We knew well over a year ago that we were going to be doing upzoning in South Lake Union. There's no reason to have started it the week after the legislation was given to Seattle. That basically sets up a situation where we give the upzone first, and then we go back and say, oh, by the way, a year later or even longer, we think you should contribute to affordable housing. That's like basically telling your kid, look, I'm going to give you dessert now, and then this evening we'll see if you want some vegetables.
Why isn't the city using the money they're getting now to build more affordable housing rather than low-income housing, Nick?
We are building as much housing as possible. We use a number of different programs. Let's point out, though, however, that most of like the housing levy money goes to up to 60%, and there are many, many people in our workforce right now that are at that 60%. In fact, one of our consultants pointed out that even looking at South Lake Union, close to half, if not more than half, of the people working at South Lake Union are security people, they're maintenance people, they're file clerks, they're hotel industry that are around. All of these people work at basically below medium income, below 60% or 60 to 80. That's where we need to address our needs.
But how does government really do that, Nick? I mean, if you looked at it citywide, as you say, you have a good economy, people are coming in, the market is driving the cost of housing. How does government actually provide affordable housing?
Well, we do it one of two ways. One, obviously, we have a housing levy, and that's providing the housing for the very lowest, often below 30%, most of it under 50%. And that's one of the ways we provide housing. We provided probably 10,000 units since the levies have started. But the other way, and this is the way that there's a debate going on, is regulatory. You know, one is incentive, the other one's regulatory. In this case, we're tying regulatory to the incentive plan. And with the incentive plan, with the zoning, you can produce more housing. You know, San Francisco is producing basically, compared to what we're doing, probably four times as much housing. There is an opportunity here where government, working with the private sector, can say, look, you get the upzone, and in exchange, like many other cities do, you have to provide affordable housing within that structure, or you pay a little bit more outside that structure.
All right, AP, you get the last word here, 1 minute. How do you see the city building, the city, like developers, private developers and public, building affordable housing in the future?
I think it really needs to be a combination of some of the strategies that you know, Nick is embracing kind of the government's role in providing that, and there absolutely is a role. But we need to make sure that when we craft policies that do this, we're thoughtful about the impact of those policies on our other categories of sources of housing. San Francisco's policy over the last 20 years that it's been in place has only housed less than 1% of its population growth over that time. So it's important because it's housing 1,200 people, and those 1,200 people are really happy. But we also need to make sure that we don't create a situation where we're taxing, putting all that burden as a tax on new development, because then we risk having the unintended consequence that we have less development.
All right. I got to leave it there. I still think we're at odds about where we're going, but it's clear. I appreciate you both making it much clearer. AP Hurd is vice president, Touchstone Corporation, author of Carbon Efficient City. Nick Licata is a Seattle city councilman. The city council is debating the question of increasing the in lieu of fee. The council is supposed to take up this issue and maybe even finish with the issue on Monday. This is Weekday.
Now we'll turn from housing to sports. The latest in the Seattle versus Sacramento Sonics versus Kings saga in a minute.
Support for KUOW comes from Retina Specialists Northwest. The offices of Dr. Brenda Myers-Powell provide the treatment of retinal and inflammatory eye diseases such as macular degeneration, diabetic retinopathy, and uveitis. More at RetinaSpecialistsNW.com.
51 degrees in Seattle. Sky is mostly cloudy. Forecast calls for showers and an afternoon high of 59. 229 or 929. I'm Bernard Ouellette. The FDA is proposing sweeping new food rules. What sorts of rules? Why do they want these new rules? And how might they affect your health? We'll find out in 25 minutes.
Last night, the Sacramento City Council approved a term sheet, a plan to build a new basketball arena. I'm Steve Scher on KUOW Today. We'll take a look at what that might mean for the effort to bring a team to Seattle. In Sacramento, they hope this show of financial support will keep the Kings from moving to Seattle. The $448 million proposal included $258 million in city money. The non-binding vote allows the Sacramento Investment Group to present their plan to the NBA on April 3rd. Seattle's investment group, led by Chris Hansen, will do the same. So, does last night's vote dim Seattle's hopes of having the Sonics return? Bob Moffitt is a reporter with Sacramento Capital Public Radio. He covered last night's city council meeting. We talked to him again. Mr. Moffitt, it's good to talk to you again.
Good morning. How are you?
I'm very good. Thanks. So last night's vote was non-binding. Does this mean the deal could still fall apart?
No. I mean, the council has spoken at this point. The only thing that might muck up the works is the possibility of a bid from Kings minority owner John Karyotis. He is one of the minority owners. He is not the only one. He has said that he is very close to putting forth a bid that he would then put directly to the Maloof family and then would go to the NBA from there. He would circumvent some of the process that the city of Seattle and the city of Sacramento have gone through as third-party bidders.
All right. So why would he do that, by the way? He just thinks he can, he doesn't want to give up the control. He wants to gain more control. He seems like he's just mucking up the works.
Well, he certainly could. As far as the city goes, as far as either city goes, he is the minority owner. He wants the team to stay in Sacramento, and he prefers an alternative site. On the same land that currently houses what used to be Arco Arena and is now called Sleep Train Arena, north of Sacramento, he and another group of local Sacramentans who have been involved with the Kings since they moved have always supported that site and have wanted to keep the team there instead of either moving it downtown or moving to Seattle. His preference is that the Kings stay. Then his second preference is that it's his ownership group of foreign investors that makes the winning bid and that builds a new arena on the existing, basically on the existing land, the parking area of the existing site north of Sacramento.
Where's the public money coming from? Some of this is binding up some parking dollars?
Yeah, $212 million from leasing out the city's parking operations, at least a great deal of them, to a private company. That would be the large chunk of it. And then there's a complicated formula of using some of the parking revenues that the city controls to then backfill the general fund loss of $9 million a year from losing that steady stream of parking revenues. There are taxes, ticket surcharges, other fees that would come and backfill that. And then there's the sale of, I think it's $39 million in city-owned property.
So Bob Moffitt, citizens of Sacramento would be probably paying a little more for parking, and visitors would be paying a little more for parking. So it's an indirect way of getting all the citizens to contribute. You had two council members voting against the proposal. What were their concerns?
Well, the concerns are that it's city money being used for a private venture. That's the argument. And they're also concerned about the potential loss to the city general fund. That argument has been, thoroughly jumped up and down on by the other council members and by city staff, who say their conservative estimates show that if an arena is built, the resulting revenue would be about $600,000 more a year than it is now to go to the general fund. So that's the primary argument, is that city money should not be used for this project. The other argument against that is that the NBA has always said it prefers to have some public-private partnership, and that it prefers to have a city that's willing to put finances behind a project like this so that the city has some stake in the game, has some stake in how the team runs, has some pride in the fact that the city is there, and then also has financial obligations and financial incentive to make sure that the team is successful.
Have you taken a look at how this deal might compare to Seattle's deal in the minds of the NBA governors?
You know, the NBA has typically been reluctant to change, you know, just regardless of what the subject matter is. And in this case, you know, you look at some of the other cities that have lost teams and what the political climate was at that time, how the team was doing, how the city supported the team, whether the city council or the public entity had voted to approve funding. And this one kind of stands alone, to the best of my knowledge, in that usually when teams have left, it's because there wasn't any effort by the city to keep them. It was people saying the private sector should build whatever needs to be built. The private sector alone should be responsible for this. We're not going to use any city dollars. And in this case, the city stepped forward and said, now not once but twice, that we're willing to do we're willing to put our money where our mouth is. We want the team. And a little sweetener to the deal, at least on this time, for all parties concerned, is that the city is not the developer on the project, has a lot less responsibility as far as running the team or running the arena, which should not probably be the city's responsibility. And also, there is the opportunity for 1.5 million square feet of development around the downtown plaza, which used to be called the Westfield Mall. And one of the things that's, you know, a couple reasons that's important is that's where the developers will make their money back on this deal, is from that development in addition to the arena. So for critics who have said, oh, well, what if they don't do the development? Well, if they don't do the development, then they're losing money. And this is a group of people who are multimillionaires and billionaires who have not made it a habit to lose money.
So, Kings fans have seen the city councils make efforts in the past to hold on to the team. How has this latest effort been greeted?
Well, if the city council meeting is any indication, the people who are in favor of an arena and who are basketball fans, who are diehard basketball fans, are certainly in favor of this. There has been I don't know if you'd call it a minority that has voiced their opinion. As far as, you know, whether city dollars should be used for this project. But their arguments have almost always been countered effectively by city staff reports or by private entities that have contracted with the mayor to put forth the, you know, a good spin on the project. And, you know, there's been no public polling done, which is interesting. And when somebody with the wherewithal to pay for that to happen comes forward, then we might see what the public really thinks about it. But I think the feeling that I get from talking to people in and around town is that people are generally excited about the offer to keep the Kings. And I think people will definitely like this arena deal a lot more than the one that they had with the Maloofs.
Tell me, Kevin Johnson is a former NBA player. He's going to go before the NBA Board of Governors in late April, April 18th, 19th. He's going to be there with Chris Hansen as well from Seattle. Does being a former NBA player help the Kings' chances to stay in Sacramento with the NBA?
I think it absolutely does. It gives him, he has name recognition for one. He has maybe a little bit more of a, he's you know, been part of this system. He's been part of this organization. He knows how things work from the inside a little bit more maybe than someone from the outside. And obviously his efforts have been successful in keeping the team not once, but now possibly twice, and that he has been able to spur efforts to bring in an arena to not one but two different locations in downtown Sacramento, and get the council and get and bring forth the project that's been able to, that the city council has voted on, and then just you know the rallying of the city of corporate sponsors. There's a press conference at 11 o'clock today to unveil a new round of corporate sponsors for the team should they stay. I think we're up to about 20 or two dozen people who have put forward $1 million as part of an investor group to buy another minority share of the team, and that's actually bankruptcy court. Proceedings are here in about half an hour. I'm halfway actually right now between the bankruptcy court and between the proposed location of the downtown plaza here in Sacramento.
All right, Bob Moffitt. Well, drive safe then. Bob Moffitt is a reporter with Sacramento's Capital Public Radio. I appreciate you taking the time to talk to us. Sacramento Kings getting approval from the Sacramento City Council on an idea to keep the team in Seattle by contributing a lot of parking money, a lot of parking revenue over many years to keep that team there and to build a new stadium. Of course, Chris Hansen is trying to bring a team to Seattle. Who knows if he's already started looking at other basketball teams, or maybe the NBA will expand. We don't know. The discussion, the proposals will be put forth before the NBA Board of Governors April 18th and 19th. Michelle Rhee, Kevin Johnson's wife, was here in our studios, and I asked her about whether he was going to be able to pull this off, and she said, never count my husband out. He's a competitor. Who knows? Maybe she is right. This is Weekday.
/9:41. Remember the so-called Minutemen, the self-styled anti-illegal immigration group patrolling the Arizona-Mexico border? Whatever happened to them? We're going to find out in a minute.
Support for KUOW comes from Nissan Leaf. The 100% electric, zero-emission 2013 Nissan Leaf has new features such as leather-appointed seating for five and never needs gas. More online at choosenissan.com.
-51 degrees in Seattle under a mostly cloudy sky. Forecast says clouds all day, chance of showers, and an afternoon high of 59. Then it's a chance of showers overnight with a low of 47. Tomorrow, Thursday, more clouds, more chances of showers, and a high of 60.
Support for KUOW comes from the City of Seattle, helping to reduce pollution in the lower Duwamish waterway by searching out and controlling sources and working with businesses to keep pollutants out of stormwater. More information online at seattle.gov by searching Protect Duwamish.
I'm Bernard Ouellette. It's 9:42. We'll find out what the FDA is proposing as a way to help prevent foodborne illnesses in about 15 minutes.
I'm Steve Scher. This is Weekday on KUOW Seattle. In 2009, two American citizens of Mexican descent were murdered in their home along the Mexican border, a man and his daughter. The wife made a 911 call the night her daughter and husband were shot and killed. Here's what that 911 call sounded like. It's very disturbing. So parents, you have a moment to turn the radio down if you don't want your kids to hear how this 911 call sounded that night.
911, where is your emergency?
Ma'am, somebody just came in and shot my daughter and my husband.
They shot them?
Please send me.
What's your?
I live in Arizona.
And what's your? And they shot your husband and your daughter. Are they out conscious?
Please, ma'am, please. She's bleeding out of her mouth. Please.
How old is your daughter?
She's 10.
10. And where were they shot?
In the head. Should I pick her up? She's not bleeding.
No, I want you to leave her where she is, okay? What I'm going to do, are they still there, the people who are there that shot them?
They're coming back in.
Shauna Ford and two accomplices were convicted of those killings. Ford was the head of a branch of the Minutemen, the anti-immigration group. working along the Arizona border. The killings were the logical outcome of the movement's nativist agenda and paranoid worldview, according to writer David Nywort. The award-winning journalist has written, "And Hell Followed With Her, Crossing the Dark Side of the American Border." He joins us in our studios. Good to see you again.
Good to see you, Steve. Thanks for having me.
A very disturbing notion, especially the end of that call. They're coming back in.
Yeah. Of course, that tape goes on for another 20 minutes, and what you hear is about 2 minutes of sustained gunfire. And she basically got a gun that her husband had left on the counter and successfully drove them out of the house. They came back in to try to kill her. And then she got on the phone and was spent another 16 minutes talking to the dispatcher and waiting for help to arrive.
You've worked on questions of American racism, American right-wing groups. Here we have another one. What brought you to want to tell the story of Gina Gonzalez and the Minutemen, Shauna Ford and the Minutemen?
Well, part of this is that, of course, this story originated up here in our neck of the woods, because Shauna Ford, the leader of the group of people who invaded that house, was from Everett, and the gunman in that case was from Wenatchee, actually grew up in Spokane area. And so these people got involved in the Minuteman movement here in Washington State. I covered those events back in 2006 when they were organizing border watches up in the Blaine area. And Shauna was part of those operations, and that's how she got all involved with them. She became so involved that she decided to form her own Minuteman Border Watch organization. She got involved in there was a falling out between the two co-founders of the Minuteman movement, Chris Simcox and Jim Gilchrist. And she basically took advantage of that rift by siding with Gilchrist, and it made her a powerful figure in the movement. And Gilchrist essentially outsourced all of his border watch operations to Shauna. Well, then Shauna concocted this scheme of financing their operations by ripping off the drug smugglers that they saw down there in Arizona. And this led to her plan to do a home invasion, which led to these murders. Of course, she was set up by another drug smuggler who simply wanted to eradicate some of his competition.
Well, who were the folks who got killed? Who was Gina Gonzalez, and who were her husband and daughter?
Raul Jr. Flores was the father. He was a 32-year-old man. His father had been a smuggler. His father had been a smuggler. This is Aravaca's little town, about 10 miles north of the border, as the crow flies, about 14 miles as you drive. And it's been a smuggling town since 1870. It's out in the middle of nowhere. And people who live there, you know, there are a fair number of people who make legitimate living there. There's ranching and mining out there. And, you know, there's a grocery store and things like that. And those people all make a legitimate living. But they live alongside people who make their living by smuggling and have for generations and generations. And Junior Flores was basically just a businessman in town. He was pretty well liked.
Was he a drug smuggler, too?
Yeah, he
was a marijuana smuggler.
Yeah.
But
he did not have the $3 million in his house that Shauna Ford thought he had. He just had his wife and daughter. You know, he was smarter than that. He didn't keep any of the material around his home.
Remind me, was this their first killings? This wasn't their first ripping off of smugglers, but was this their first murders?
No. Shauna had attempted to murder her husband up here in Everett in December before. She had her boyfriend go to his house and shoot him 5 times. She stood to gain $500,000 if he had died intestate, because he was in the process of divorcing her at the time. And so this would have been the biggest haul she ever made. And her plan was to use this money to go buy a ranch on the border in Arizona and use it as a compound for training her super militia.
Right. She just sounds like a criminal. What makes her, in your view, an integral part of the evolution and the decay of this nativist right-wing identity that some Americans are, you know, searching for?
Well, there's no doubt that Shauna was, you know, really a crass opportunist, and she was really using the movement as a means of kind of creating a new image for herself. She had been a career criminal. She had committed her first felony at age 11, had been a teen prostitute in Seattle. Had a long career shoplifting and committing credit card fraud and all kinds of crimes, and really had a rap sheet as long as your arm. And but when she married John Ford, she decided to straighten her life out. And so she was able to join the Minutemen. You know, this tells you how good their vetting process was, that they didn't discover she had this long criminal record, because she just, all they did was check her name under Shauna Ford, because once she had married John, who was a very much a legitimate guy, very nice guy, she was able to sort of clean up her act.
Wow.
And so, but she really had this aspiration to, had this heroic idea of herself, and thought she was saving America from illegal immigrants.
David Nywaard is an award-winning journalist. He's currently senior editor of the blog Crooks and Liars. He's been in the American Prospect, Washington Post. His previous books include The Eliminationist, How Hate Talk Radicalized the American Right. His latest book is And Hell Followed With Her, Crossing the Dark Side of the American Border. So how did this, what impact did this murder and the subsequent trial have on the Minutemen?
It basically destroyed the movement. There are border watch operations out there still, but they all studiously avoid the name Minutemen because, as Al Garza, who was the former Minutemen spokesman for Chris Simcox, put it, he says, you say Minutemen anymore, people think you're a murderer. And it's true. It really pretty much ruined the brand name for them. A lot of the former border watchers have, like I said, tried to form these other organizations. They haven't really gone anywhere. There isn't much demand for them anymore because there aren't the hordes coming over the borders that there were in 2001 or 2005. And finally, really what's happened to most of them is that they've kind of melted into the Tea Party. Glenn Spencer, one of the significant figures in this Border Watch movement, is really very active in the Arizona Tea Party now. And he's drawing in people like Sheriff Joe Arpaio and Russell Pierce as part of the scene down there.
So in covering and tracking the American right wing, the American far right wing, is the Minutemen's nativist agenda, as you call it, the paranoid worldview, also absorbed into this Tea Party anyways in Arizona?
Oh, yeah, very much. I mean, really, as far as the Tea Party is concerned, its immigration agenda is identical to the Minutemen's anymore. And it's not just in Arizona. It's pretty much nationally.
So do you think even though we have this murder, even though we have this criminality, it didn't really people involved in the movement saw it as an outlier?
Well, yeah. I mean, they saw it as just an aberration, when in fact it was really pretty much part of, I mean, the attitudes that led and belief, sort of the belief system that fed these murders, it was very much common throughout the movement, and it's still very much with us today. Essentially, it's this attitude that these people have disposable lives, that, you know, they're not real human beings anymore. And so we can dispose of them because, you know, Shauna had this idea that life down on the border was cheap, partly because there had been so many drug murders down in Mexico. And her assumption was that this would just be a blip and it would be, that these murders would be blamed on the cartels. Unfortunately, Gina Gonzalez shot back, and she wounded Jason Bush, and he ran screaming out to their car and leaving a nice little DNA trail for investigators to find. So their plan to have it all be blamed on the cartels didn't work out so well.
How do you feel about, I mean, in writing this book, you were trying to pin down hell following her, but also where's hell going next? How do you feel about what is happening in the American right-wing movement, far right-wing movement today?
Well,
in terms of safety, in terms of danger, in terms of what it means for the mainstream of America.
Sure. Well, I think that actually since President Obama's reelection, it's gotten much worse. We're actually seeing a significant upsurge and have since his election seen a significant uptick in domestic terrorism in the state. We actually have more than twice as many events involving right-wing domestic terrorists in the country than we have. Well, everything ranging from, James von Brunn's attack on the Holocaust Museum to the cops who were murdered in West Memphis, Tennessee, by the Sovereign Citizens. I've got a running tab of about 77.
Do you think people look at Shawna Ford? Other people look at Shawna Ford as a hero?
Well, not very many.
Or do they just
want
to forget about her?
No, the people in the Minutemen movement. There are a few diehards who claim that she's, the victim of a conspiracy to discredit the Minutemen, and including her friend Lane Lawless, who screens all of her interviews. So that was why I was never able to interview Shawna. And there are some diehards, but mostly they've moved away. I mean, Jim Gilchrist has pretended assiduously that he had no very limited association with Shawna Ford. And in fact, they were very tight.
Where is Shawna Ford now?
She's on death row in Arizona, as is Jason Bush. The third character in this was a man named Albert Gaxiola. He was the local smuggler who set them up, and he accompanied them on the raid. And so he's basically serving life in prison with no chance of parole.
And where's Gina Gonzalez and her daughter, who wasn't home at the time and so survived?
They're living not in Aravaca anymore, but she's living with her parents in a town south of Tucson. So, and she's basically cleaning houses now.
How does she view these people who came down and changed her life?
Well, Gina hasn't done any interviews. I've listened to her testify three times, and I have chatted with her in person privately a couple times, but she's never granted any interviews. She has said, she just, when she testified in trial, Shawna's trial, she just said, I don't understand how someone could have that much hate in their heart that they would kill my little girl, so.
David Nywort has written a book about this event and its implications for America and hell followed with her crossing the dark side of the American border. He's at Elliott Bay tonight, and then Friday he's at the Secret Garden Workshop, and then next Thursday at Third Place Books. You are going to be here for a while talking about these issues.
Yep, I will be. And, of course, immigration is really kind of the underlying issue here. And I think hopefully we can use the book to help kind of change the tone of how we talk about immigration. I think one of the overriding lessons that I think we want to convey is that when you start going down this path of demonizing people and turning them into subhuman objects, and hating, sort of scapegoating these people, scapegoating immigrants for the supposed criminality, that this distorts the conversation in such a way that we can't really have a rational discussion about immigration when really the problem is a whole box full of messed up laws rather than we're blaming the victims for the problems that are created by our laws. And we really need to have a discussion about that.
We'll see if that starts it. We're having some of that discussion, but we'll see.
Yeah.
All right, sir. Thank you.
You betcha.
This is Weekday.
And now, the sound of the day.
Pete wrote us. He said, I live on a dead-end street in a greenbelt by a lake in Bellevue. There's no turnaround at the end of the street. Each week, the yard waste truck has to back up the full length of the street before making collections. The primitive sound of the backup alarm echoes through the woods. And he writes, I imagine hearing a pterodactyl circling in the sky before swooping down on its prey. I get that. So what are you hearing, and what imaginary vision comes to mind? Record 30 seconds of a sound of your day and send it to us, along with the story behind it. Email it to weekday@kuow.org with the sound of the day in the subject line, and be sure to put that story in there, that fantasy, like Pete's. Stay with us. More Weekday ahead.
The Supreme Court heard oral arguments today concerning DOMA, the Federal Defense of Marriage Act. The proceedings have concluded. We'll find out what happened in the news in a moment. KUOW FM Seattle, KUOW Tumwater, KQOW Bellingham, and Digital HD Services.
Support for KUOW comes from PCC Natural Markets. PCC has partnered with Washington growers and producers for more than 40 years to provide the community with fresh, local, seasonal foods. With 9 neighborhood locations. More at PCCNaturalMarkets.com.
-52 degrees in Seattle and mostly cloudy. Forecast calls for showers today with a high of 59. Then it's a chance of showers overnight, dropping down to a low of 47. And tomorrow, Thursday, cloudy again. Thanks for listening. The program you just heard was made possible by the financial support of our listeners. Support this program and others like it by making a pledge today at KUOW.org.